This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
So before we begin today's Dharma talk, I just want to say how grateful I am to Coach and Steve Tierney for coming all this way at the hinge of winter here in Austin. You're in this apocalyptic forecast, but he rode the winds in and hopefully he'll ride the cold back out home on Monday. He's been practicing for a very long time, starting out in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition in the early 90s. But he is a Soto Zen priest, in case the robes didn't tell you that. In our lineage, practicing in our lineage. He's also a board member of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, which is the kind of umbrella organizations for priests in our lineage, a wider lineage of Soto Zen in North America, and lectures and practices widely in the Bay Area and beyond, and is a psychotherapist, addiction specialist, suicide prevention, all in his basket. And so the full Zendo is a testimony to how much this topic speaks to people. And thank you again.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Take a deep breath and relax. We just talked about addiction and suicide prevention. We're not going to jump right into that. So. What I'd like you to do, though, is just take a look to your left and your right. And if your neck works, turn around, look at the person behind you, in front of you. Yeah. How many of you actually pause long enough to really look? So now try it again. Very good. What I want to talk about this morning is that my view of Soto Zen is that it's a gift. It's a gift in our lives. We are spiritual people, and the gift is you and me. And sometimes we forget that it starts with me. So the person taking the look and making eye contact and making heart contact, I'm a gift to you, and you're a gift to me. We just met, but it doesn't matter. So I want to start out by reading a little bit, a book I've been enjoying. It's by Paula Arai. You may know her. This book is called A Little Book of Zen Healing. And it's Japanese Rituals for Beauty, Harmony, and Love. I'm just going to read a little bit. You may seem like I'm going on and on, but I'm not, I promise. Beauty beckons us to focus on the present moment by enticing us to notice what is happening here and now. We are invited into deeper relationship with ourselves, our loved ones, and our world. Being in the presence of beauty signals it is safe to open up, though it can be scary. We are vulnerable, exposed, even ashamed. It takes courage to open. Though our circumstances differ, all of us experience pain, doubt, and fear. When we don't tend to daily healing, negative experiences can calcify and form bricks, with which we can and often do build walls to our hearts. Barriers can feel protective in the short term because they shield us from the full force of misery, but they leave us stranded. They restrict our view of ourselves and our world. The narrowed perspective distorts what is happening, making it easy to see what confirms our fears. When we feel threatened, which intensifies fear and sometimes even generates hate for ourselves or others, over time we begin to think that that's all there is to see. While hidden behind barricades, we become disconnected from others and out of touch with much of the reality around us. Ignoring or destroying reality drives very deep, drives away deep love and prevents liberative healing. Beauty's most potent power is to dissolve the obstructions that block your view from the fullness of where you are. In accepting beauty's invitation to open up your senses, you amplify the senses of your heart, and this can help you stimulate awareness of what really matters. So that's Paula Arai, and the book is called A Little Book of Zen Healing. It just came out a few months ago, and it's really good. And if anybody happens to be free on Monday, she's doing an online workshop for the SCBA, which is you can go on for very reduced fees, including none, if that's what you can afford. So if you happen to be free, it's SZBA, Soto Zen Buddhist Association. I should know that. Anyway, there you go. And so just if you happen to be interested in her and are free on Mondays. And I imagine that they're going to tape it so you can listen to it afterwards. But what I want to talk about is my real sense that life is complicated, and we tend as humans to further complicate it by worrying about the complications. Thinking about when you first sit in meditation, you're trying to get rid of the thoughts about what you should have done differently than yesterday than you did. You might be thinking about the person next to you sitting much more erect than I am. And then you might try to pursue the breathing that they're breathing. And because that seems like perfect Zen breath. And then later you find out they have bronchitis. So there's all this complication that goes on in our minds. And we really can get into it, as most of you probably know. So when I came to Zen practice, it was in large part because I had heard a person named Sharon Salzberg give a talk, and she said that what drew her to Zen practice was the possibility of a life lived in peace, ease, and authenticity. Does that sound about right to everybody? You're living lives in peace, ease, and authenticity? Yeah, good. You made it. It's a trick question because you are. So as we begin the new year, you know, a lot of folks in different cultures have rituals to think about as the one year ends and another begins, that it's a good time to do an assessment, to reflect on where we're at. And I think, you know, it's New Year's Eve is a construct, and we know how many people respond to the idea that they're reflecting on their past year. By having a day that's filled with some beers in the afternoon, some scotch before dinner, some wine with dinner, some bourbon afterwards, and then at midnight, some very cheap champagne that results in not remembering anything, much less what you did last year. Some people. Other people come and do a lot of bows and ringing bells, which is another way of ushering out one year and welcoming in the new year. But the fact of the matter is, as Buddhists, we know that the reality is this year was a Monday. New Year's was a Monday. Just like any other Monday, we have the opportunity to take stock of what kind of person I have become and what kind of person I would like to be. And that seems to me to be one of the core aspects of Buddhism, of Soto Zen. And for me, I think of it as gifts that keep on giving as long as I participate in them. So a teacher of mine once told me not to bother to make resolutions. He said, because people, if anybody's been near a gym this week or the last couple of weeks, you know, the physical fitness industry makes most of its money by selling year-long discounted memberships in January. They are for 52 weeks. And I read an article last year that said the average amount of time a person actually engages in that 52-week discounted membership is 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. 6 weeks, and that's an average. So, you know, some folks pay it today and do one workout and never go back. But he said to me, don't make resolutions. Think about what's important in your life and what's valuable to you. And he used the example, I had made a resolution every year for the previous 10 years, during which he was my teacher, to lose 50 pounds during the next year. And every year I showed up with that same 50 pounds still there. And he said, stop making that resolution. It's obviously not something that you value. What you value is eating comfort food because you need to be comforted. So maybe you want to take the backward step and find out what it is you're trying to comfort and work with that. And that would be good for you and good for the people who eat with you and good for the people who experience you. And I'm happy to say that I was able to hear that, and I weigh 80 pounds less than I did when he told me that. And so it worked. It was like not just a resolution to do something cosmetic, but a resolution to take a look at what was actually behind all that. So Rumi, the poet, said, try not to resist the changes that come your way. Instead, let life live through you. And do not worry that your life is turning upside down. How do you know that upside down is not better than the way it's been today, unless you try? So in Buddhism, one of the things that we do is live by vow. By vow, we are Buddha, as the Buddha told us, and Dogen reminded us. The gift of Buddhist practice, it seems to me, is the freedom from having to make decisions that are about me, thinking thoughts, taking actions that are just about me. And so in my early life, and perhaps for a moment at the airport yesterday, my survival required me to make decisions about me and my survival. The world hadn't been fair to me, et cetera, et cetera. Yesterday's major trauma was that there was only one coffee spot and there was a very long line. And all of my peace and ease and authenticity was sitting right here on my shoulder, wondering if I was going to watch it or behave badly. Happily, I did without coffee. So that was a good thing. But that's what we get to do, it seems to be. Excuse me. One of the gifts is that we have this opportunity to be relieved of making decisions that are just about me. Zen practice offers us a path to figure that out. And the path is what we all did this morning. Those of you who are new and those of you who have been around a while, we did something which we refer to as shikantanza. We just sat. We just sat. So we had this opportunity to not hopefully worry about who was breathing next to us or did we have posture. Anybody have pains in their knees or hips while they were sitting this morning? Or neck or fingers or anywhere, and still we sat. And hopefully, depending on the teachings here, so I won't interfere with those, but hopefully we sat and noticed that sometimes that pain is just a distraction because our mind wants to get busy with something, and so my knee hurts or my shoulder hurts. Sometimes it's a distraction. But Blanche Hartman, who was the Abbess, first woman Abbess at Zen Center, used to tell a wonderful story that she came to Zen practice late. She desperately wanted to get into a full lotus position, and she kept trying and kept trying. And so she got to the point where one day she said, oh my goodness, I'm in a full lotus position. And she said she thought two things. One was, how many of her colleagues at Zen Center had knee surgery in the past year? And two was how old she actually was at that point, and what on earth was she doing to her body? And so she developed a way of sitting that made sense for her body. And she did it because one of the things, the gifts, and I'm going to talk about the gifts that we have. One of the gifts is that we are teachers, all of you, even if you just got here. You are Buddha, and Buddha means teacher. And that gives us the opportunity, right? And so you might think, I just got in the door. Don't be calling me Buddha because that makes it feel like a cult and I'm going to run up the door and leave. Not that. Just means that Buddha is my heart is open to your heart is open to my heart. Our minds and our hearts are connected together and it's all a good thing. But that we teach 24/7. So if we sit Zazen in 2 weeks for half a day, and then you go down the street to the nice whole food, whole wheat store, and there's a long line and you get cantankerous with somebody in line or behind the counter, you're still teaching. You were teaching by sitting because I'm looking at this person and they're showing me how to sit and I'm showing them how to sit. She's showing me how to sit, so we're doing that. And then that's teaching. But then also the way we walk down the street. Do we get up from Zazen and run down the street missing a cute puppy in the yard or the house that they just painted pink and green down the street and get to the store and we're impatient? All of that's teaching. So as we have the opportunity to bring this practice into our hearts and our minds, we get to say, ah, I'm a teacher. And everything I do is on display for other people to see. And they say, how is he living? How is she living? How are they living? And how are they carrying out this life of the Buddha? And so that's a gift that we get because we get to start over every single minute. We live in the present moment, you hear us say over and over again. And so where do we find that practice? And in the Fukunzen Jinji, Dogen says, the Dharma is amply present in every person, excuse me, but without practice, it is not manifested, and without realization, it is not attained. So that's the invitation to come and sit, the invitation to talk to a teacher, the invitation to talk to good friends along the path of awakening and enlightenment. In Buddhism, we call that Kalyanamitta, a good spiritual friend. And that's everybody here, even if you just got here today. You're my friend, I hope, and I hope I'm yours. So what Dogen then said was to cease practice based on intellectual understanding. Learn the backward step that takes the light inward, which is the reflection I talked about a few minutes ago, and remember to not think good or bad, to not be judging yourself, but it's practice. So if it works, if it causes you to feel calm, if it causes you to feel connected to each other, then do more of it. If it causes you to feel disquiet and it causes you to be frustrated, I'm sure this has never happened to any of us, frustrated that the person sitting next to you in Sesshin or Zazen smells a little bit like garlic or like their cat or something. And so we suddenly say, what's going on here with me? So if it's not making you feel good, that thing that's happening, just take a deep breath and start over. Just take a deep breath and return to the practice, right? So Dogen also said, which is one of the things I liked when I first came, he said to remember intelligence or the lack of it has nothing to do with practice. This is not about studying and taking some final exam. He said, in fact, that it's simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, that Buddha, in teaching us the practice and giving us the practice, really meant that if you come and sit for 30 minutes just breathing, not thinking about the bills you have to pay, not thinking about, you know, the words you spoke to someone important in your life that may or may not have been as generous and kind as you would like, if you're just doing that, then the reality is that in this 30 minutes or 45 minutes or half day or a full day or 7 days, you get the real opportunity to just rest. Like if some of you are runners or you work out and do things with your body, you know that after a couple of days, you're supposed to take a rest, because then your muscles and your body can respond to the rest as well as to the work. And so that's an opportunity we have. And he says at the end that when we do that, the way he phrased it was, your treasure stores will be open and you will be able to use your treasures wisely. Treasures are all the things you gained. Thich Nhat Hanh teaches, some of you have probably read his stuff, Thich Nhat Hanh taught that we have two storehouses actually, negative seeds and positive seeds. And we gather them up as we go through life. People were nice to us, people were not nice to us. We got something we really needed, we weren't able to get it. We got something we needed and then lost it, etc. So we have storehouse of negative karma and positive karma, and he referred to them as seeds. And so the question was, which ones will come to fruition? And the answer is, everybody knows, right? Whichever ones we feed and water. Whichever ones we feed and water. So I think that we have this number of gifts. Practice, just sitting, just getting there is the first gift. And the next gift that is really important for me is the gift of renunciation, the renunciation practice, right? And so that's really important. And when I first heard about it, I thought, the renunciation. I was a person in recovery as I found my way here, although both sort of happened simultaneously. And I thought to myself, when I heard the first talk about renunciation, I thought, I've given up alcohol, I've given up drugs, I've given up unhealthy relationships. And on good days, I've made less bad choices about food. What's left? Now I'm here in the Zendo and they're telling me I have to practice renunciation and give some stuff up. The gift that I got and that I try to share with folks, and I think it's so healthy, is it's the same for folks, if anybody here is in recovery or knows people that are, there's a process that happens of taking an inventory. And the reason you take the inventory is exactly what we're talking about here, which is to say, what are the things that are in my life that are nourishing? What are the things that are neutral? What are the things that are depleting, right? And you take a look at those things, and then you have the opportunity, and the depleting things often are things that we've done or said that we learned in response to the way the world treated us or our family treated us or, you know, some stuff that happened. So they were survival tools. And we take a look at those, and we say, those things are not actually making me happy anymore. And as Paula Rice said in her work, we begin to build up a wall. And some of us think of it as a brick wall that keeps other people out and us in. Some people think of it, and I prefer this metaphor, of a cocoon. And we're inside the cocoon because it's safe and it's warm. And you know, we can be protected from all the slings and arrows, real and imagined, that might be out there. And then suddenly, hopefully, as you practice and as you get a fuller sense of who you are, the cocoon gets too tight and you can't be in there anymore. You need to spread. And, you know, remember who's in that cocoon. It's not nature's prettiest animal. And all of a sudden, you knock open the sides of the cocoon and out comes a monarch butterfly, right? And so you're in there in the dark as a little thin creature. And when you come out, you've got these big, beautiful wings. And so it's probably good to think of renunciation as, what is depleting or not good for me? And what is actually nourishing for me? And, you know, some things in life will be neutral, and as time goes on, you may have time to work on those to move them into another category. But it's good to look at those things, because the things that are depleting, when you move those out, as we do in an inventory, there's more room. If you don't move out some of those negative things, if you don't move out, you know, there was a time in my life where to walk into this room filled with people, even to be sitting back there, would have made me really nervous. I don't know any of these people. Am I going to like them? Are they going to like me? And so I was able to have that behavior because I thought I needed it to protect myself. And now I'm able to take a deep breath and say, I'm going to not be sitting back there. I'm going to be sitting up here. I could be nervous. Maybe probably am if we took a pulse or something. But the fact of the matter is, we're all here on a Saturday morning because we're spiritual people trying to improve the quality of our lives, because the quality of our lives impacts everybody else that we encounter. And in fact, in the biggest sense, not even people beyond whom we encounter. So a teaching says that renunciation is one of the most beneficial, empowering, and freeing practices in all of Buddhism, as its purpose is to heighten the best qualities of our hearts and minds, right? So the best qualities, taking a look at what's going on in there, and what I had to do to get through this day, or what I had to do to get through, you know, the week that you just had at work, if you're working, or school, or even in retirement. Let me tell you, sometimes it's like, how did this week go by so fast? And I'm supposed to be retired, and I'm exhausted. So you get to take a look at what you're doing, and those things that are not nourishing, you know, you get to get rid of. And the reason we do it is, again, going back to 24/7, we're teaching. So if we're walking around in life being really anxious, or being really closed off, or being really angry, or being really fearful, people see that, you know, and they might say, wow, you know, this person has been practicing Buddhism for 20 years or 30 years or 2 weeks, and they seem to be sort of losing it, you know, what's going on here? And so that's teaching. And so if we say, I'm feeling some stuff, and I think I'm going to try to let that go, and then if I try to let that go and that doesn't work, you turn to the person that you just smiled at a few minutes ago and say, you know, I'm having something going on today. Can we just talk for a minute? Can we walk around the block? Look for some flowers. Look at that pink and green house down the street. Go to the coffee place that is not open again this morning. I was so excited just as we got here. I was told where the little coffee place was on the street. I got went strolling down there just as big as life. It was closed. In California, the coffee shops never close. You never need to be energized, I think. So the idea, again, in renunciation is to get rid of that. You know, there wasn't coffee there, so I went for a walk and breathed in the Austin air, and that was fine. So the idea is to make room for ourselves for new thoughts, new beauty, new joy, and new connections. And Thich Nhat Hanh said very clearly that the first noble truth is suffering. And so there is suffering, and we all understand that. But suffering is not enough. He taught, until he died, that we have a responsibility to create joy and to create beauty and to share that with others. Mm-hmm. If somebody's having a bad day and you ask them to go for a walk, they may say no. But the fact that you ask them, you know, they will not forget. Maya Angelou said, people may forget what you said, they may actually forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And so that seems to me one of the gifts that we have. When we make room for joy and beauty in our lives, when we make room for taking down the bricks, when we make room for busting out of the cocoon, we actually are having this experience that other people can see. And they think, wow, he used to be really uptight and nervous and whatever, and he seems to be calming down now, which is the wisdom of recovery programs. You know, they have people come to the rooms over and over again, so you can see, like the person sitting there, wow, they were difficult for a while, and now they seem calm. They were unemployable, and now they have found a job. They were certainly undateable, and now who knows what they're doing, but that's another talk for another day. But that's the wisdom of those programs, is you see people over and over again, and some people heal, and some people don't. And you can look at the lesson of what to try and what not to try. And so one of the other important gifts that we get is that we are instructed, Suzuki Roshi said at one point in a talk that he gave, that you're invited to an all-inclusive, non-judgmental panoramic awareness. So no negative self-talk, no opportunities to say, I fell down. You know, the Buddhist teaching is if you fall down 7 times, that's not important. What's important? You get up 8, right? What's important is you get up 8. But I love that expression, an all-inclusive, non-judgmental, panoramic awareness. So if I encountered this beautiful person on the street, and we can't remember where we know each other from, so we just sort of nod and walk past, I might walk down the street and think, oh my God, I just gave a talk that said, don't do that, speak to people and say, do you want to go for a walk? And then I didn't do it because I was on the way to the coffee place that's not open. But it's not to be judgmental about that, just to say, you know, I recognize that as a human being, I gave a talk in Berkeley a couple weeks ago, and I saw a person coming in, and I was in a rush to get, I was right on time, which means late. I was right on time, and I was trying to get in the door, and she clearly wanted to talk. And I said, hey, how are you doing? And she started to answer. And the next thing I know, she had her hand on my shoulder, and she said, you ask me how I'm doing, I'm going to tell you. And right. I just took a really deep breath, and that would be an opportunity to judge, right? To be judgmental about myself. And I said, nope, I think that's not a good idea. I just need to slow down. And if I get inside a few minutes late, I can explain to people that I was doing the work of a Buddha outside by simply being fully present with someone. And so Chogyam Rinpoche said in Tricycle Magazine, there are two kinds of positive thinking. One kind is that the future is going to be all right. The future is going to be all right. And he says that kind of thinking is based on panic and concern with security, right? The other kind is not living in the future, but living in the present moment, right? So that's the other kind of positive thinking. And he says that the Buddha nature has nothing to do with the egoistic sense of self. Basically, in essence, being awake, which we already are, you already are all awake and you're all Buddha, and we don't have to think up something positive to do. If we live in the present moment, we allow ourselves to get rid of the notion of, did I just speak to the person long enough in the parking lot? Or did I do something horrible by rushing right past? And the answer to that is, you did what you did, and you'll have another opportunity to do something about that. And so how do we find out what renunciation, what things should we let go of? And what things, if we start thinking about that, our minds are, you know, the National Science Foundation says we have between 16 and 60,000 separate thoughts each day. Imagine 60. And before I came here, mine was probably about 120,000. It was going all the time. But even if it's 16, that's a lot of thoughts. But more concerning than that is they found that 80% of those thoughts were repetitive, and 80% of those were negative. And they did some testing with students, and they did testing with adults, and they did testing with the elderly, and it's consistent. So that when we just go to our minds, one of the things that happens is we go to the negative. So if we start a practice of renunciation by saying, what things are not adding to my spiritual life? What things are not adding to my capacity to be human with human, then we have a tendency to go to, oh man, I can't believe I've been practicing for this many years and I'm still a mess. I can't believe I did that again. I can't believe, as I said to myself in Berkeley, that I just walked past this person. And the good news was, as I was walking past, having that immediate thought, there was a hand on my shoulder that said, you're not going to walk past. So that was the work of the Buddha that she was doing, I think. But the next gift, meditation is the first gift, allowing us to have the reflection. Renunciation is the second gift that allows us to say, what's getting in my way? What's blocking? What can I get rid of that's about me, that's about ego, that's about the executive self? And what decisions can I make that are about us? You know, us as the two of us standing in the parking lot, or us as the Sangha, us as the people you're in relationships with or used to be, us as members of our global community. And so one of the things that we can do is the next practice, which is a gift, which is called mimitsu. And you've probably talked about that here because the good Reverend has thought about it and taught about it before. But mimitsu is the defining characteristic of the Soto sect, according to Suzuki Roshi. It is the flavor, the style of lineage, bringing mindful attention to everything. It's like, oh no, I'm already too busy. Oh my God, mindful attention to everything. How's that gonna work? But mindfulness, as it's usually taught, is about us, is about inward, bringing the light inward, as Dogen said in the thing I read previously. And so you bring the light inward, and it's like, okay, so that gives me a chance to reflect, give me a chance to practice renunciation. But mimitsu is paying attention to everybody and everything, everything in the planet. And it points outward, therefore. So if I'm coming in here and I'm wanting to make sure that I learn as many people's names as possible and that I get everybody's pronouns the way they want them and the correct way, and that when we stand up, we fluff our zafus and put everything back, because those are all things that are important. We bow a certain way as we come into the room, and the bows are about respect. We bow to each other at certain points. That's about my respecting the Buddha in me respects the Buddha in you. And that's why we do that. And as I said, we're all Buddhas. So you can do that to anyone all day long. Although in the grocery store, it will make people think you're a bit odd. But that's all right. So podcast called No Zen in the West, Jiru Mark says, mimitsu is about what I can give and not what I can get. It invites us to see the practice as something from me and not something for me. So it is about intimacy. It is about knowing, being careful to know things. Because if we know things, just like if we know people, much less likely to be harsh with somebody who we know than who we don't know. Much less likely to walk by the yard out front if we don't know it, if we've never paid attention, or if we've come and done some volunteer work and helped plant the flowers and stuff, then we know it. So Suzuki Roshi defined it as being very careful in doing things and very considerate. And your own Reverend Choro gave a talk at Chapel Hill in 2019 in which it was said, intimacy in Zen is something that is closely tied to not knowing, to having no answer. The not knowing provides the opportunity for awakening, right? Because if I have a fixed idea about who you might be or who you might be, then it's going to be hard for me to not have that filter up when we actually start talking. But if I'm practicing this careful practice of mimitsu, then it's like, I don't know. And so if I get a chance to talk to you, it's going to be great because it'll be a fresh, everything new. Not knowing provides the opportunity for awakening. And thirdly, the awakening opportunity depends on encounter. So it's vitally important to take the time. You know, how many of you rushed anywhere in the last 2 days to get here, perhaps this morning? That's the best example. Yeah, how'd that work? So, you know, we get up and we're going to practice Zazen. We're going to be still. And it's like racing to get the dog, the kids, the family, the partners, the car, whatever, taken care of before you come to find an open coffee store. You know, so there's all these things that you must do. And so it becomes this awakening opportunity depends on encounters. Slow down enough to notice where you're at. I'm pretty sure everybody who walks down the street today will be looking for that pink and green house. And it's cute. So somebody spent some time on it, we should notice it. So our commitment as bodhisattvas or as Buddhas is to renunciation as an active commitment to be free from our fixed ideas. Suzuki Roshi told us in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, instead of a deep understanding of all the teachings of Buddhism, we should have a strong confidence in one teaching, that we all have Buddha nature, that we are all Buddha. And the great truth is that we've been whole from the very beginning. And what this practice is about is realizing it. What this practice is about is coming to understand that and realize it. So I want to skip ahead because we want to get time for some questions and answers. So I'll do the very favorite thing that speakers can do in my talk, which is go to the last page. And so I want to read you a little poem by Cahil Gibran. He says, "It is said that before entering the sea, a river trembles with fear. She looks back at the path she has traveled, from the peaks of the mountains, the long winding road crossing forests and villages, and in front of her, she sees an ocean so vast that to enter there seems nothing more than to disappear forever. But there is no other way. The river cannot go back. Nobody can go back. To go back is impossible, is impossible in existence. The river needs to take the risk of entering the ocean, because only then will the fear disappear, because that's where the river will know it's not about disappearing into the ocean, but about becoming the ocean, about becoming the ocean." So I think that as we receive the gifts of this practice, the gift of being still, the gift of being perfect just as you are, and you could all use a little improvement. Suzuki Roshi taught us that. You are all perfect exactly as you are, but you could all use a little improvement. But we get to say, but that doesn't have to be negative. I don't have to, beat myself or feel badly or live in fear or live in shame. Shame has absolutely no value in spiritual practice, no value at all. We can feel that something we did could be done differently and that something we don't want to do again, but to be ashamed about it, the fact is you did it in the moment, and you did it for a reason. You did it for some reason of protection or because you felt threatened or because whatever. So what you get to look at is, what was I trying to comfort? What made me feel threatened? In my own early practice, there were often times when I would feel like somebody had said or done something really horrible. And then what I learned from talking to friends and teachers and a few therapists was that sometimes I was really angry about what they said, and so that to the person would ask the simple question, "What did she actually say?" And I would struggle for a minute and then repeat, "She actually said," which wasn't what I heard. Sometimes it was a sentence that I could interpret that way, but wasn't necessarily meant that way. And so you get this opportunity to say, I can do things a different way. Rebecca Solnit has a wonderful new book called There's Still Time. I don't know if anybody knows Rebecca. She writes about the planet, and she's really quite wonderful, and she's one of us. It's about practicing Buddhist. So she says, transforming our suffering doesn't mean that we're going to be returned to the state that we experienced before, but we can discover that suffering and loss give us a greater ability to live in the present rather than to constantly be overwhelmed by the past. Some of us receive this precious opportunity in this time to use these struggles that we are experiencing to dedicate ourselves to fostering sanity, care, and justice beyond ourselves. So again, the invitation to not look in, but to look out and to be connected to as many people as possible. And then she says something really important. And if we cannot, then we do not turn away from that. Sometimes we have to pause, not ready to take the next action that we think needs to be taken. And we need to listen to that wisdom that sometimes it's really important to just rest. There's going to be an all-day neighborhood cleanup, and you've not been feeling well, and you've worked really hard, and you're taking care of some other family members, children or adults or parents maybe, and you're exhausted. And you think, but I have to show up. My commitment is to be with my Zendo when we clean the streets or whatever. And sometimes the real commitment, if you're sitting and listening, and you're doing renunciation and giving up that need to always be all things to all people, you get to say, I'm exhausted. And the best thing I can do is get some rest. It'll be better for me, for my vehicle. It will be better for the people that encounter me, and it'll be better for the members of the Sangha, because I'm not bringing whatever it is that exhausted me to this activity. And so in that book, her book, she also quotes Harukma. If you wonder why I keep struggling to read, it's because my eyes are really dry right now for some reason. But anyway, Murakami. And he's a writer who wrote Kafka on the Shore. And he says, and once the storm is over, you won't remember how you made it through, how you managed to survive. You won't even be sure whether the storm is really over. But one thing is certain, when you come out of the storm, you won't be the same person who walked in. And that's what a storm is all about. So it's the opportunity to go through whatever life presents, to not think it's all about me, to not think I need to solve it all by myself. Sangha is one of the primary gifts of Buddhist practice, of Zen practice. And so we get to come together and say, things went really well today. I'd like that to happen again. Let me check out with somebody if what happened was just me being selfish all day long and paying attention to myself, or if it was something where my mind and my heart and my practice were connected, or things were not good today. And I don't want to have another day where things are not good, or where I cause somebody anger, or I walk around, you know, grumpy or whatever, and people say, that guy's been a Buddhist for, you know, decades, and look at him. I don't want any of that. And so then I talk to a teacher or to a fellow, and they say to me, yeah, you know, maybe you need to go home and get some rest, or eat something besides, what would you call it, Detroit-style pizza. maybe a salad to go with that or something. But anyway, in true closing, I just want to thank you for letting me be here. And this afternoon, we're going to talk about how, when people's lives actually have a mental health event or mental health crisis, how we can be present for them in a way that is helps them to get what they need, is safe for them, is safe for us, and creates safety in the community. Because that's the first important thing somebody needs if they're having an emotional, a cognitive, a spiritual, or a mental a separation from true self, authentic self, is they need someone to be fully present. The vows I've made for myself this year are to be present, to be pleasant, and to be connected. So those are vows that you're invited to borrow if you'd like. Present, we've talked about. Pleasant is, you know, the Dalai Lama, when asked what his religion was, said kindness. And so it's to show up as absolutely often as I can, taking the time to be kind, taking that moment, minmitsu, to taking careful attention to everything. And so in closing, I would just, I looked at the website for the Austin Zen Center, and it's beautiful. The Austin Zen Center offers a peaceful haven for engaging in the task of self-discovery through Zen practice. Our intention is to help all beings realize their true nature. And so today, as you look to your left and right one more time, you are the gift. You're offering that gift to the person to your left, to your right, behind you. And so I say in closing, let us be in harmony with our intentions, in harmony with our hearts, in harmony with our minds, in harmony with the pledge to be present for all beings, that we may live with peace and ease and authenticity, that we, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the Austin Zen Center, may practice wholeheartedly, reducing our suffering and modeling that behavior for all beings. Thank you. So I think, what's one for our tea and cookies?
Right. Whenever.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's not coffee.
No coffee. Tea. Cookies.
This is one of the great mysteries of Austin, that they begin at the... Simple goat you're talking about, they start at 8 and they close at 3.
Yeah. And there you don't need coffee at 3. Anyway, so we have a few minutes if anybody has a thought or a question or wants to pursue any of those ideas. And then at some appropriate point, we'll have tea, and we'll bow out first and then have tea and cookies and a chance to talk to each other some more. And then many of you, I hope, will come back this afternoon and do some skills development. So, any questions or thoughts or ideas? It's always good to say that just before you say it, and then you get to tea and cookies. Yes.
Well, I had a thought the other day. I was thinking about monkey mind. Mm-hmm. And I was driving, and I saw one of those big swarms of birds, you know. It's called a murmuration, but, you know, when birds swarm, and they just dive and jump, and there's thousands of them, and I thought, I think I'm going to call that murmuration mind. Mm-hmm. And so when you said that thing about 1600 or 16,000 thoughts a day?
Thoughts a day, yeah.
Is it 16,000?
16 to 60,000.
Thoughts a day. Oh yeah, that fits with my new way of looking at monkey mind.
Yeah, and I think once we know that we have way more thoughts a day than we can actually put to use, then we get to take the backward step and say, okay, so let me just look at them like birds in the sky. That's kind of cool.
It's a pleasant way to look at it.
And I'm going to pick some of those to act on. I'm going to pick some of those to react to, probably, because I'm human. And then at the end of the day, I get to say, I reacted to those four, and, you know, just made me anxious or made me feel like I should be doing something else. So maybe tomorrow, there's lots of birds up there in that pattern. So tomorrow I'll focus on some different ones. But in a way that's not, you know, it's not judgmental. It's like, it's that all-inclusive. It's like, yeah, they're all there. And they'll all be there tomorrow. 80% of them will be there tomorrow. So I get a chance to say, let me be gentle with myself. Let me be careful and intimate with myself, because I have much, much higher probability of being that same way with others. Thank you. We'll all be looking for the birds today. Yes?
You mentioned the way that shame is something that doesn't have value in spiritual practice. But I know for myself, maybe for others, it can be quite a sticky mind state to get into sometimes. So I was curious, in your experience, what has been helpful for you in moving through that when it arises?
Yeah, thank you for that. And what was your name?
Trudy,
thank you. Thanks, Trudy. I think that, you know, I think what's helpful to me is just that practice of saying, I'm going into this, I feel shame. I've been in Buddhism for so many years, I've been in recovery for so many years, and yet I got impatient in a line at an airport. It's like, what's going on? And it's like, oh, I can't believe I haven't learned this. Like, yeah, you know, and, you know, maybe somebody from the Austin Zen Center is in this airport seeing me behave this way. And that, so I'm teaching them, you know, whatever. But it's that, simply to take a gentle look at that. It's like, so now I'm feeling shame, you know. There's Brené Brown, I think she says, guilt is I did something wrong, shame is I am something wrong, right? And everything in our Buddhist practice says you are not something wrong, you are Buddha. And so if you start to have negative self-talk about yourself, then you're talking about the Buddha. And, you know, chances are you wouldn't do that. If whatever it is that's troubling you, it's like, I can change that. Maybe I need to get some help to change that, but I can change that. If it's not nourishing, and it's not neutral, it's actually depleting, maybe I can get rid of that. And there are tools to get rid of it. Meditation, arousing mindful awareness about why I do that, taking the backwards step to say, what was the pain? You know, when I gave up drinking, it was I could stop having alcohol, but I was drinking to soothe and heal something, right? And so I could keep trying to give up alcohol until finally somebody helped me say, why? What is it you're trying to heal? And you take the backwards step. And that healing and comfort couldn't come immediately or quickly. And so there were times when, you know, there was that alcohol again. And it's like, okay, so I could feel ashamed about that, or I could say, I need to do more work on the healing. And so the shame, there's actually a book that says the upside, it's called The Upside of Shame. Don't read it. do not spend any money on that book. But what the book suggests is that it can be motivating, right? It can be motivating, that sense of shame that, you know, here I am again doing something wrong, not thinking of others, but thinking of that executive eye. So I feel ashamed about that. And the book suggests that that could be motivating. Well, I think what we know here is that love is the motivation. Love for yourself, forgiveness for yourself. And in fact, for me, someday when I come back, have a forgiveness talk. That forgiveness practice ends with nothing to forgive. There's nothing to forgive. You did what, you know, that you always hear people saying, well, my parents, they did the best they could. And then they talk about what their parents did, and it's like, no, they didn't. They did not. They did what they did. And now you have a life that's built on that. And so I don't need to forgive them. That's their spiritual practice. I need to love them and accept them and surrender, but I don't need to forgive them. And so they don't need to feel shame. They did what they did the best they could for them, probably. And so for you, when you feel that sense of shame and it's sticky, you get in it. I really some practical things. You know, you could sit some meditation and just arouse mindfulness about what's going on here, and what's the real cause of that? Because it's probably not whatever you just said or did. I did this thing, or I should have done this thing, or I can't believe I missed another report at work and I feel shame because whatever it is. It's like, so what was going on for me? Why was I being resistant? Why was I, and so when you look at that, there's ways to change that and fix that. And shame, for most everybody I know, is actually not motivating or useful. It's painful. And I loved your word sticky, because you get in there and it's hard to get out. But getting out is about saving your life. So get somebody to help you. Suzuki Roshi also said that when we fall down, all you do is reach out your hand and somebody in the Sangha helps you up. And when you get to be 72, you'll know how important that metaphor is.
I think it's similar to the previous question. What I struggle a lot with is visiting with a feeling or visiting with a thought, mm-hmm. and actually writing that thought or writing that feeling, and how I disengage from it in a manner that allows me to visit with it rather than push it away. Mm-hmm. So if we can help me in that space.
Yeah. I think it was Rumi who said that those are like visitors, and there are many visitors outside your door. It's Suzuki Roshi. Rumi or Suzuki Roshi. Those are my two folks today. And Paula Iran. Lots of folks, all these folks today. Anyway, what they said was there are like a lot of folks outside, and it was Suzuki Roshi, actually, now that I think about it, who said, be very kind to them, but don't invite them in for tea. Mm-hmm. Be very kind to them, but don't invite them in. Because I think now that you know that you're having 60,000 thoughts a day, you can take a look at that and say, if I spend this much time being in angst or concern about every thought I have, I don't have time to do anything else. And so the joy is to pay careful attention with that, some formula. Mine is just that very simple, nourishing, neutral, depleting, and it works for me. So if it works for you, feel free to steal it and engage it, or come up with a different one that suits you better. But the deal is when that thought starts to come and it's starting to get hooked, right? Kermit Shodron has a book called Hooked Unhook, right? Mm-hmm. So many things hook us, and we get to make a choice about unhooking. And most of us don't realize in various parts of our life that we have that option, that that's a choice. And we'll talk about that this afternoon. Sometimes we think that's a thought pattern that we can't do anything about. And sometimes in the moment it is, but there are solutions. And so when you feel yourself getting hooked, just say, "Is what is going to be the benefit to me of staying hooked on this thought? And what's going to be the benefit of me being hooked to the people that I encounter in the next couple of hours?" So sometimes I can't get rid of a negative thought from my own, just because, that would be ideal. I am Buddhist, so I don't want to, be cluttering up Buddha's mind with that thought. But sometimes if I can't do that, then I can get rid of it, because it would be better if my mind were clear so I could talk to all of you. Or hear, deeply hear all of you, even more important.
And on the online, he's got his hand up. He's got a virtual hand up. I think he maybe has a question. Ed, are you?
Ed,
yes.
You have a question?
Can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
Well, thank you. More of a comment. First off, thank you very much for being here with us today. And I'm really grateful for what you said about recovery. I, too, am a recovering alcoholic. And and you could probably agree, for me, a lot of foundation of my practice also is based on that recovery. On recovery and how well they work hand in hand. And I just want to point out that if it wasn't for the 11th step meditation, I don't think I would have ever put the two together. And I'm very grateful for that. And it's just nice that there is no shame, as you said, in recovery or in anything. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Glad you're here. Yeah, I think the 11th step, for those of you who aren't familiar, it says that we made that through prayer and meditation. So it encourages both prayer and meditation. And it comes right behind step 10, which tells you to reflect on how you did today, what you did today. A lot of people, that's an opportunity to list all the stuff they messed up. But that's not in my practice, in the practice of people like Ed and others. Step 10 is an opportunity to say, what did I do today? What do I want to, what worked and I want to do more of it? What didn't work, I want to do less of it. What brought me in more connection with people, I want to do more of that. What separated me from people, I want to do less of that. And then you go to meditation or prayer. But in meditation, you say, okay, let me sit in bliss and repose and think of a life in which that was actualized, in which I embody those things that are important to me as a Buddha and as a Buddha in recovery. So I think that, again, it's whatever we can do, that minmitsu practice, to pay careful attention, to be open to the possibilities, to be willing to let go of the renunciation practice, to be willing to let go of the stuff that is harmful to us or that makes us feel shame. Yeah. Anybody in the other room?
I had a comment. I'm an online person.
Hi. Melanie? Yeah.
Yes, welcome. Hi. One thing that struck me about your talk was I just can say I often have a focus of myself, me, what, how can I get better or improve or all that kind of thing. And what I noticed about what you said and what I like is how even the talk this or your workshop this afternoon is about someone else, not just me. And I think that's something that I really value about practice is the saving all beings part. And it just struck me, the your focus on what effect do I have on other people and connecting with other people. And I really appreciate that.
Mm. Thank you. Glad you said that and glad you're here. Yeah, the poet Havit said, I wish I could show you when you are lonely or in darkness, the amazing illumination of your own being. The amazing illumination of your own being. And I think that's it. It's like if I stop and look at any of you, I can say, wow, what a beautiful person. And I want to get to know you and to share some time and energy with you. And then the person's thinking, stop looking at me. I'm not feeling that way today. and that's coming from a place, that we often, if we just think about ourselves, if I go, there's this beautiful walkway around here that I want to go find later today. And if I just go on the walkway and by myself, that's one kind of enjoying things. But if you're sharing, appreciating the nature that you're seeing on the walkway, or walking with someone, then you get this opportunity to say, maybe it's not about me. Maybe it's not just about me. But Buddha was very clear, and Suzuki Roshi is really clear when he teaches us, that the care of others begins and ends with care for yourself. So when we talk about caring for all beings, you are one of them. I am one of them. And so we can't just get busy and be doing 40 hours of volunteer work a week, plus your job, plus sitting for 12 hours a week, because you run out of time. So, part of it is the care of others begins and ends with care for yourself. So in order to be fully present and engaged and careful and intimate with other human beings, we have to come back to ourselves and, as Dogen said, turn that light inwards, make sure that we're taking care of ourselves as well. And if we do that in connection and relationship with others, it works a lot better.
Thank you.
Thanks. Nice to meet you. Any other questions or thoughts? Yes. And I'm Martha, right?
My name is Pat.
Pat, sorry.
What do you have to say to people who are introverts, who really need to be by themselves a certain amount of time to regenerate and keep up their energy?
Yeah. I think what we say is that to take the time, right? to take the time. I think, and if you're able to be here this afternoon, we're going to talk about where how people assign those kind of words to themselves. It may be that I thought of myself as an introvert because I'm in a cocoon. Right? And so I think of myself as an introvert because I don't like being around people. I keep my own counsel. Well, you know, I can assure you in my life experience that almost nothing good comes from keeping my own counsel all the time. This is not a good neighborhood to live in by myself. So I think it's okay if you know that being by yourself is nourishing. At being at home, sitting in a chair, reading a book, listening to some music, or just meditating, you know, just being still. If that's actually nourishing, then by all means, keep doing it. But I think what you want to do is to find some balance. What we know is that an introvert is somebody who goes out and is in a crowd of people, and it takes energy to be in the crowd. An extrovert is somebody who gets energy from the people, right? That's all those two words really mean. And so you can assess that. It's like when you go to a party or you go to a family, as a therapist, this is my busy time of the year because everyone was just with their families. So if you've gone to be with your family or some other crowd and you find yourself, I did it, you know, we got through. How many people heard somebody say, I got through the holidays? Somebody said the other day, oh, Christmas and New Year's, yeah. I'm so glad they're in the rearview mirror. It was December 22nd. So it's really an opportunity to take a look inside. Like, do I really like being by myself all the time? We know that there used to be, for about 10 years ago, it became very popular for people to say, I'm not lonely or isolated. I'm practicing sacred solitude, right? And I'm sure that there were a few people who were practicing sacred solitude. And for everybody else, that was a gimmick. That was, you know, Oprah or Brene Brown or whoever thought it up, sold it to us. And there were people saying, oh, yes, I practice sacred solitude. Well, what does that mean? It means I walk home with my head down on the eyes facing the sidewalk, get in my car, drive straight to where I'm going, go in the house and close the door, and I'm lonely. But I don't know what to do about that. And so instead, I've turned it into a practice. And you can. You can turn it into a practice if you say, why am I wanting to be by myself? Am I wanting to be by myself because, you know, other people have hurt me, or because I'm not confident of my own capacity to be kind when somebody in front of me in line decides they need an iced latte with half warm and half cold milk? So I'd rather not be around that person, right? But that's not everybody. So I think introvert is being in a crowd requires energy. And then when you've done something that requires energy, it's good to go back and build your energy up to restore. And that's a gift, to know that you're somebody who, after doing work with other folks, needs to have some time to herself to restore your energy, to rejuvenate, to reconnect your heart and your mind. Perfect. You know, and there's nothing wrong with being an introvert. But it's just to know that, in fact, if that's true, is it working for you? You know, when you pay careful attention to it, is it a way you like to live? And if you do, more power, wonderful. But then, you know, just the balance. You're here today, so you're not entirely an introvert. And you've lay entrusted so that you are a teacher. And you do all sorts of wonderful things here with all these people. So I'm guessing that you somehow find the energy to be quite well loved in your community, right?
Yes.
Completely
true.
Pat will be going home now to close the door. Turn off the lights and pull the shades. Anyone else on screen and in Zoom rooms? Somebody has a beautiful pink flower there. We should go find it and look at it. Okay.
Yes. Thank you so much for your talk. I'm Jenny, and every time you mention coffee, I keep thinking about the coffee that's in my car. But I appreciate.
Where's your car?
It's less cold right now, but it's still coffee. So I really appreciate you talking about the need for rest and self-care. I know that's a gimmicky thing too, but And I've been trying to practice that. I do a lot of social justice work, and you know, I'm thinking about, I think it was MLK that said, talked about like the fierce urgency of now. And you know, I do a lot of doing organizing work for Gaza, and you know, it feels urgent. And I also know I have to take time, you know, or else like I'm not good for anybody in the long run, and it's not about me. But I guess, like, you know, from a Buddhist perspective or a human perspective, like, how do we balance that when there really are urgent things, you know, that really demand or should demand our attention and action?
Thank you, Jenny.
Audre Lorde said self-care is not self-indulgent, it's an act of revolution.
Yeah.
And what I think Audre was trying to say to us is that you can, you know, hopefully we are all very concerned with the people, particularly the children of Gaza, and we are, and it is urgent, and there are things that we can do. And then the other is, like, we can be angry and frustrated and just furiously pissed off with our government and some of the other government, all that stuff, and that's like this vat of mud, right, that's thick and supple and reasonable, and of course any reasonable person would have some of those feelings. And if you have other feelings, you know, I'm not trying to take sides politically until we get outside afterwards. But what we know is that you can get stuck in that mud. Like, it can be like that they did something to a school or a hospital yesterday, and I spent my entire day responding to that. And so what did you do? Did you fly over there and help the kid? No. Did you organize a rally? The San Francisco City Council passed a resolution condemning Gaza, which is a beautiful thing. And we have a huge homeless problem, and 1 in 5 children in San Francisco County goes to bed hungry at night. So on the one hand, great that they passed a resolution, and it does bring attention, and I respect that. But it's like, instead of spending 2 days on that, perhaps they could have adjusted the city budget to get some more money into the children's food programs in the county. And so what I think you need to do, or I need to take that back, what the invitation is to practice this mimitsu, to take careful attention to, if you're working yourself ragged emotionally and physically, doing the work about that important project, are you taking care of you so that you can be kind to the people that you live and love with, and the people that you work with and other folks? Because what happens otherwise is we forget that from that mud will grow the lotus of a solution, of how you can be meaningfully involved in supporting a permanent ceasefire, and frankly, an end to all war. Mother Therese was asked if she would come to an anti-war rally, and she said, "No, I will not." They were stunned. They said, "What?" And she said, "No, I will not. If you have a rally for peace, I will come to that. To be against something is not nurturing. To work for something is nurturing." And so what you're doing is working for peace and working for justice. And the important thing about that is for you to know that you're doing something that spreads your Buddha nature, that your love, your organizing capacity, etc. And the minute that it starts being depleting and causing you to be exhausted and not engaged with the people right around you, it's just something to take a look at and see if you can rebalance.
Thanks.